from the studios of KPCW in Park City. It's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Now, Larson, my typical co-host, is on vacation this week, so joining me as guest co-host is Larry Warren. Thanks, Larry, for coming in.
Hey, my pleasure. Glad to be here, and especially since our first two guests are couple of old friends.
There you go. Well, last June, Rocky Mountain Power stated in their integrated resource plan that due to relatively flat demand, they had no plans to build any new solar or wind farms until after the year 2020.
So that was last June. Well, that plan held up for about 9 months. Of course, they're constantly updating. In March, Rocky Mountain announced plans to construct a 2-megawatt solar farm in southern Utah, about enough power to power 500 homes on a continuous basis.
Right. So joining us to discuss the particulars of this project and why Rocky Mountain Power decided to build this farm will be Paul Murphy and Dave Eskelson, spokespersons for Rocky Mountain Power.
And in addition, they'll share with us some of the other changes to the company's energy outlook, especially in light of the EPA plan to establish new emission standards for existing coal-fired power plants.
That's all in the first half of the show. And in the second half, Larry and I will catch you up on some environmental news, including why Ohio is shaking over fracking. A seaport town in Canada says no thank you to tar sands pipeline. And a Kansas congressman says no to GMOs. Labeling, that is.
The environment, our connections with it, and impacts upon it. That's what This Green Earth is all about. So stay tuned. We'll be back with Rocky Mountain Power.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power offers watt-smart advice such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. because it helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at wattsmart.com.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Joining me this week as my guest co-host is station manager Larry Warren. And what we thought is we'd start off talking about Rocky Mountain Power and one among other things, their plans to actually build a solar farm down in southern Utah. And to help us explain some of the particulars about that and some of other Rocky Mountain Power's plans is spokespersons Dave Eskelson and Paul Murphy, and we want to thank both of you for taking the time to come in this morning and chat about this.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with this project. It seems like it's somewhere around 2 megawatt, as we said in our intro, a 2-megawatt solar farm. Give us some particulars about where this plant might be and the schedule for construction, et cetera.
Some of the sites we're looking at are down in southern Utah, and we found out that those areas can produce actually about 15 to 20% more energy than if we built one in Salt Lake. At some point, we will be looking at facilities in Salt Lake, but right now we want to get the most bang for the buck. And so we're looking at properties that we actually already own, and we would like to build a project that has 9,000 panels and that will produce enough energy for 500 homes.
Okay.
2 megawatts. Eventually, we'd like it to be a 5-megawatt project, which would be enough power for 1,250 homes. But what I think is exciting is that in the past, our Blue Sky program has been used to buy renewable energy, solar or wind, from various outfits. But this time we're actually using our Blue Sky customers to help build a project that will bring them electricity to their homes that's renewable and clean.
Right. And that's an important point. This is Blue Sky funded. So the I sign up for Blue Sky program. And so the dollar I give you is now at least a portion of that will actually go to constructing a, in this case, a solar farm.
Is this the first time you've ventured into building solar facilities?
This is our very first solar project for just Rocky Mountain Power. Our parent company is actually building the two largest solar projects in the world. And so our parent company has been doing this for a long, long time, but this is our very first one. Correct, Dave?
Yeah, that's right. Blue Sky was originally focused on wind power primarily. And as the cost of renewable energy credits and really the cost of renewable energy of all types has come down, there has been, thanks to our Blue Sky customers, additional funds available to do other kinds of projects. And so we've done – Blue Sky has funded a lot of solar rooftop projects. You know, last year – or earlier this year, we announced a bunch of those Blue Sky solar projects on lots of churches. They were really involved in that.
Yes, we had two here in town.
Yeah.
Temple Har Shalom and Church of the Good Shepherd.
Yeah, but this new solar project is interesting because it's more of a utility scale project. It'll be some property of a reasonable size, and it will put energy on the grid just like any other power facility.
So any sense of 9,000 panels? That sounds like a lot. Any sense of the acreage that's involved in that?
I do not know.
Okay.
It's large.
That's one of the challenges with solar is that it can require a large footprint.
Correct. You need a lot of land, and that's why it's important that we already own the land so we don't have to add those expenses to our customers.
Okay. And again, what's the schedule for breaking ground?
Our schedule is to have it up and running by June of 2016. So this summer we hope to announce the exact location. We'll then present it to the Public Utilities Commission, and then we will ask different contractors to make a bid on building the project for us.
Okay. Now, in addition to that, back on April 1st, I hope there was no pun intended here, but another a private fund, Skatec Solar, announced plans to build an 80-megawatt solar farm down in the Cedar City area of Utah. So this is a huge – this is 650 acres. Of land that they plan to set aside and build a solar farm. 80 megs, that would be enough energy to provide electricity to 18,500 homes, according to their press release. What is Rocky Mountain Power's involvement in this? You have to basically agree to purchase the electricity they generate from that, correct?
This project is one of a number that has come in recent years. They're called qualifying facilities under a particular federal law that was designed back in the 1970s to provide an incentive for small power production. So assuming that they meet certain requirements, they make a contract with the company. The utility, Rocky Mountain Power, is obligated to take that energy. But it's done with the oversight of the State Utility Commission. So the Utah Public Service Commission reviews that contract, makes sure it's in the public interest, make sure the price is reasonable, holds customers of the utility harmless, and then those private developers can go out and build those projects. And if you look at kind of what's on the horizon, there's probably around 300 megawatts of capacity in qualifying facilities that are seeking to build projects in Utah.
So solar, seems about as green as anything can be. But there is a footprint. I mean, you eat up a lot of land to put out the solar arrays, and you have to string wires to get things on the grid. So is there any way over time, and panels have been out there for 25, 30 years, are they getting more efficient? Is there any chance that someday you wouldn't need this kind of land? Or is it not an issue because out in the West we have plenty of land?
Well, I think the land issue is certainly a concern. I think with any energy production, there is an environmental impact, and any time you have to manufacture something to generate electricity, there's certainly an environmental impact to any of that. The use of land and solar is probably its biggest environmental factor. It's no question that both the efficiency has been rising for solar panels and the cost has been coming down. And that is what's driving its increased use in many areas of our business.
You know, you listen to NPR News, and sometimes they have a little break. They talk about Florida Power and Light as put the kind of combined natural gas-fired systems with solar and Learn More, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I actually had an opportunity to visit that facility. It's along Lake Okeechobee, and it is pretty impressive. There they use what's called parabolic mirrors to actually heat a liquid, and then that liquid turns water into steam, et cetera. The system is 190,000 panels, okay, and it requires 500 acres. And you need 500 acres to match the natural gas-fired system, which will then run at night, which takes about 20 acres. So there's an example of Larry saying it takes a lot of land, like you're saying, and you know, it's 500 acres versus 20 acres. That's the challenge. It works. The system works well. But that's, you know, acreage right now. And you – Dave, talk a little bit about the efficiencies that we get from solar versus some of the other sources of electricity. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. The efficiency of solar panels has come up, but it's still a little it's still substantially less in terms of how much of the sunlight energy is converted.
Mm-hmm.
Solar plants are very promising in this area. Natural gas has been used increasingly, particularly the last 10, 15 years, largely because the latest combustion turbines, they're combined cycle units, and they also, in addition to producing energy from the turbine itself, they also take the heat of that turbine and also generate additional energy with the heat that comes off of there. So you can get efficiencies at a natural gas plant of you know, in the mid-50s, maybe even 60%.
Okay. Whereas solar?
Solar is, 8 to 10% efficient. But, of course, with solar, you have no fuel cost. So
right.
Everything has an advantage and everything has a cost.
And then the other, wind farms started popping up a few years ago, like rows of corn in windy places. And I toured one just over the line in Evanston that actually was a Florida Power project.
Yeah.
Is Rocky Mountain invested in wind, and is there much demand for wind, and is that very efficient?
Yeah, we have lots of investment in wind. We started wind projects back in 1998 in some places in Wyoming that have really good wind density. And it was really advances in wind turbine technology during that period that prompted the company to make those investments. And we ratcheted that up in a big way after 2006. And today we have 1,800 megawatts of capacity in wind power, more than 1,000 that we own, and about 800 megawatts that we purchase from private developers, among those some of those folks in the Evanston area. But generally, what we have found as we looked around for the best wind sites is that some of these high plains areas in Wyoming were really good sites for two reasons. One, available land, and two, proximity to the transmission system that
right.
we own. And those have been really the factors. And because Utah is about 42% of our company's business, we get here in Utah quite a bit of advantage from those Wyoming wind projects.
Okay.
So Rocky Mountain Power is actually the second largest rate-regulated utility for wind power. But the largest is actually our parent company. So we're very well invested in wind.
Okay. But then tell me, when I turn my lights on, what percentage of electrons roughly are coming from coal versus wind? Now, the number I have heard is it's 80%. Is that what is the – what would you say?
Well, right now for coal, it's about 60%, but in 10 years, it's going to be 46%. And what you're going to see is more natural gas that's going to fill in that void and then, you know, possibly more renewables as well.
Right. Okay. If you just join us, we're speaking with Paul Murphy and Dave Eskelson. They are spokesmen for Rocky Mountain Power. We're talking about, among other things, a recently announced plan from Rocky Mountain Power to build a solar farm down in southern Utah, some other private ventures going on. Let's talk a little more about the integrated resource plan. We mentioned in the introduction that that plan is usually kind of a map, I guess, for all intents and purposes, of what Rocky Mountain Power is producing today and what they see down the road as far as how much power is required, how much electricity is required, where that electricity will come from, et cetera. The Integrated Resource Plan was put out on the street in June of 2013, and it was just updated in March.
Yeah. The Integrated Resource Plan is rewritten every other year, and then it receives a shorter update in the off year. So what the current plan shows, including the update that was just released at the end of March, was that primarily due to the acquisition of new wind and natural gas plants in recent years, the company really doesn't need new resources of any type for about the next 10 years.
That, you know, coal has been the bread and butter of power generation in Utah, and a lot of coal exports to other states to generate power elsewhere. Has the use of coal peaked? It sounds like it's peaked in your company and will continue to decline.
Yeah, we haven't had a new coal project in our 10-year plan for the better part of 5 years.
And, in fact, you're retiring one plant.
That's correct.
And you're building more renewables.
Building more renewables, but there again, our recent construction program has positioned us pretty well for the next 10 years. To the extent that customer growth will happen, some of our states are essentially flat. Utah's growing a little, but much slower rate than it was before. So we're going to be able to provide for our customers' growing needs from purchases on the open market from other utilities and the increased use of our energy efficiency programs. Our WattSmart energy efficiency programs have been very successful and are now a significant source, a significant resource that we can draw on to the extent that customers conserve energy. We can then use that capacity elsewhere.
So in the near future, at least 10 years, no coal, no additional coal is in the future. And the way the trends are and the way renewables become more efficient, and of course we're awash in natural gas, is it unlikely that Rocky Mountain Power would ever build another coal plant?
Seems unlikely.
I mean, we are closing one coal plant this year and actually going to be converting another a unit at a coal plant to natural gas. So coal is it's on its last legs.
Do you see additional opportunities to swap out existing coal with natural gas fired units?
It will be an option,
right,
that will be explored as particularly as air quality regulations become increasingly restrictive. But it's something that we'll do on a unit by unit basis. It probably won't pencil out in every case.
Right. And that's obviously a function of the price of natural gas, too.
Exactly.
Right now, it's very attractive, natural gas versus coal.
And one of the reasons that our new power project decisions in recent years, I mean, everything that we've built since 2000 has been either natural gas or wind. And the projections, again, in the Integrated Resource Plan, that's one of the factors that it looks at is the forward price of natural gas looks favorable for quite a long period in the future.
Well, what really fascinated me was this fact that your demand, your peak demand for electricity continues to drop. I mean, the IRP of June 2000 had a had a growth, a slight growth to it, like you say, very, but less than expected. And the revised plan has an even lower expectation for demand. As you say, it's flat in some areas, just a small growth, say, in Utah. And that speaks to people's using less, in effect, either using what they need more efficiently or simply just, well, like us here, turning the lights off.
Right. We think our energy efficiency programs have been very effective in helping all of our customers lower their bill, but it also results in more efficient use of electricity.
Well, now here's the rub, Chris, because this happens when everybody, all the water utilities say conserve water, don't use as much water, and then because we don't use as much water, there's less income coming in from water sales,
right.
And the more we save in terms of water, the more we spend in terms of cash. Is that going to be the case as demand continues to stay flat or decline at Rocky Mountain Power? Does that mean you're going to need higher rates?
Well, that is a factor in the price of electricity and the price of water, because the way prices are designed in both of those utilities, both of those essential public services, a lot of the fixed cost is in the charge for the commodity. A lot of the fixed costs are in the charge for the energy. You know, to extend service to a residential customer probably costs about $25 a month. But the current customer service charge for residential customers is only $5. And so what we have proposed in our current price increase request is a slight increase from $5 to $8. And that's the same principle that is behind the request to institute a $4.25 charge for customers who use their own power generation. It's an effort to make sure that the costs of extending the service are more in line with the costs generated by the customer who does it. To the extent that that utilities ask people to use less of its product, there is kind of a perverse result the way that rates are currently designed. And really, that's an artifact of rates that were designed decades ago, and they need to be updated.
And in terms of cutting power demand, you encourage conservation because the cost of building a new plant to meet higher demand just doesn't pencil out over the rate structure.
Yeah, if you look at the cost of demand side management, energy efficiency, incentive programs to help people install more efficient appliances, insulation, so that their appliances and particularly cooling systems work better. The cost of that, you know, per kilowatt hour is less than building a new power plant.
So you actually benefit from me using fewer electrons.
Yeah, the system benefits.
The system benefits. Does the system's life expand? You know, the life cycle of your substations and power lines?
Not really.
It doesn't benefit it on that much on that side.
Okay. No, but I mean, part of it, though, is fuel is only 25% of the bill to bring you electricity. 75% is those fixed costs, the poles, the wires, the substations, everything like that. So things are going to be changing, I think, in the future and how we charge customers and try to make it more fair so that you don't feel that ding for actually doing what we ask you to do to conserve energy.
Okay. You made an interesting point, Dave, about water. Water plays a big role in producing electricity. And in this state, water is precious. So are you guys looking at the effects of water supplies and how that might play a role in your fees, et cetera?
Oh, definitely. We have pretty extensive water conservation programs at all of our power plants. And the use of water in a thermal plant, basically to cool the steam and circulate it back to the boiler, is a big issue.
Yeah.
That was one of the reasons when we built the Current Creek power plant in Mona. That's a natural gas plant. That plant was designed to use air cooling rather than water cooling. And that was a factor driven in large part by the availability of water in that area.
Right. Okay. So air cooling works just as well.
Actually, it doesn't work just as well. Okay. But
it does when you don't have water.
Yeah, it's a good option. It's a good option when you don't. There again, you have to have a lot more infrastructure and a lot more land. If you look at the cooling array at Current Creek, it's basically a huge radiator, much like an automobile radiator. But it's a huge piece of equipment and covers a pretty wide area, and it works well on less water.
Yeah.
But you know, water cooling is more effective.
Right. But those are some of the realities that we're faced with
out west. And that was a conscious decision on the company's part.
Let me just veer off another direction slightly. Your project is to build photovoltaic cells over a fairly large swath of land. Is that the best use of solar power? Anyone who's driven I-15, if you get right to the California line, cross over from Prim, Nevada, you can see off to the right as you're driving south the Solar One project. And I've been watching that rise for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And that involves basically a gigantic water tower up, several hundred feet, surrounded by mirrors that reflect the sun back to the tower. It's just a huge and impressive-looking project, but I just wonder how efficient that is compared to just putting out photovoltaic cells that have been around forever.
Well, it's largely a factor of what you want the resource to do. An installation like that has certain capabilities that photovoltaic arrays do not, but a central station solar collector, you know, where you're basically using the heat of the sun to generate a thermal cycle, much like a natural gas or a coal plant or a nuclear plant for that matter. You're using a heat source to boil water to steam to drive a turbine and generator. And there you get larger volumes of electricity, but of course your capital costs are much greater. And so it becomes an economic analysis. You know, what do you want the resource to do, and how much capital are you willing to put in? The capital requirements of a large photovoltaic array are not as great as on ultimate project cost as a central station collector.
Rocky Mountain Power have any plans for those central station collectors like that?
No.
Okay. That's fair enough. I want to thank you guys for coming by and chatting about this project and your integrated resource plan and some of the challenges you guys face going forward with some of the proposed regulations on existing coal-fired plants that the EPA is going to be sending out in a draft form, I believe, in June. And how you're going to have to respond to that. And we'll probably have to have you back when that comes out and get your thoughts on those things too. Paul Murphy and Dave Eskelson are spokespersons for Rocky Mountain Power. And again, thanks and best of luck.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay. Hey, let's take a little break for some underwriters. And when we come back, Larry and I are going to chat a little bit about a couple of items in the news, including Canadian tar sands, some fracking issues in Ohio, maybe some GMO chat, the usual environmental things, right, Larry?
You betcha.
It's This Green Earth. We'll be back right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage service and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Welcome back to This Green Earth.
I like your theme music, Portlandia.
Oh, it's a great, great show. The group's called Washed Out, Larry.
Love that show. I didn't know. Okay, Washed Out.
Washed Out is the name of the group.
Excellent.
Great stuff. this is one of the reasons I come in to the show.
My wife just does not understand that show. I think it's hilarious.
It is. Anyway, we'll talk more about that show later if we have time. But let's talk a little news on environmental issues. Let's start with this article, this story I got about some earthquakes showing up in Ohio. Okay. Now, I start with this one because last week, Larry, as you remember from listening to last week's show, Nell and I did a story about seismic activity in Oklahoma. And Oklahoma has been experiencing more and more seismic activity over the last couple of years. Last year, they broke a record. This year, in the first 4 months of 2014, they have logged more seismic activity than all of 2013.
Wow.
All right. So, they could take the rest of the year off if they wanted, and they break a record in seismic activity. Now, there, seismologists were suggesting that some of the seismic activities related to not the fracking process, but the injection of the wastewater that comes out of the fracking process. You know, there's millions of gallons of water are used, and then when you pull that water out of the ground, you got to do something with it. It's a chemically combined wastewater, and so what they do is deep well inject it, maybe 1,000 or a couple thousand feet into the ground, and that was suggested to be the cause of some of these small earthquakes, you know, 2 to 3 in size, that are occurring repeatedly and with greater frequency in Oklahoma. Okay, so that was last week. Fast forward to this week. Here I pick up a story about similar conditions going on in Ohio, but in this case, their seismic activity is being suggested to be caused by the fracking process itself.
And that's probably why it's made so much news. I mean, this has been in the not just environmental blogs, but this has made national news.
Yes, and so these are geologists in Ohio are beginning to link earthquakes in geologic deep formations to hydraulic fracturing, and it's leading the state to issue new permit conditions in certain areas that are among the nation's strictest. So now, again, these seismic activities are small, you know, relative to what we experience out west. These are seismic activities anything from 1 to 2, mostly less than 3. But, you know, enough that you might feel them and you prefer not to have them around.
It's a little disconcerting when the ground starts moving.
Yeah, exactly. So what the Department of Natural Resources in Ohio has announced, the new permit conditions, saying that all new drilling sites within 3 miles of a known fault or seismic activity of 2.0 magnitude or higher will require the installation of seismic monitoring equipment. Now, the results of that, what those equipment monitor, the results of that may result in the drilling to be paused for evaluation, not canceled, or it could be canceled. Let me revise that. It could be canceled if a direct link is found between that fracturing activity and an earthquake. So these are new regulations that no one has ever imposed before, and so it puts hydraulic fracturing at risk related to potential seismic activity.
And generally what you've heard about hydraulic fracking in terms of criticism has been about the chemicals involved and fracking chemicals reaching groundwater and affecting water pollution. So this is a whole other wrinkle to a whole other side effect to the fracking process if it's actually causing the earth to move.
Right. And up to now, at least in Ohio, seismic monitoring is voluntary. The drillers, you know, voluntarily would monitor it. Now the state of Ohio is going to require that all drilling sites monitor for seismic activity, and depending on the nature of it and the linkages, they could halt the drilling.
And some states have they not?
I'm not aware whether other states have done that. I don't know if it's going on in Pennsylvania or West Virginia or Oklahoma or so. But this could set the stage for additional states, regulators, to kind of consider seismic activity with respect to fracking. So it's an interesting development given that 30 to 40% of our natural gas in this country comes from fracking.
And fracking is a process used in the Uinta Basin here in Utah.
Right.
So it's somewhat close to home.
Yeah, something to pay attention to. Okay, so that's the fracking story. Let's move on to what's going on with tar sands. This is a tar sands story that doesn't involve XL Pipeline, Keystone XL Pipeline. How about that?
Okay.
All right.
You can get off your
we'll get off that for a minute.
Get off your high horse on that one.
And move to another high horse. This one, Keystone XL is TransCanada. That's the company that's trying to build that pipeline.
From Alberta down to the Gulf Coast.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Now, Enbridge is another tar sands related company that want to build a pipeline west from the Alberta tar sands over the Northern Rockies in Canada to, among other places, a small port in British Columbia called Kitimat. And that would be the port of departure for all this oil west, of course, to China, Japan, Korea, the Western market, Asian market. So Kitimat would benefit greatly from a pipeline coming into their town.
180 full-time jobs.
There you go.
In a small
in a small town
with a seasonal economy.
Exactly. But they recently the citizens took a vote, and a non-binding referendum type of vote, and by 58% to 42%, they voted no on having the pipeline come to their town. Now, I say it's non-binding, but it may influence the city council of Kitimat when they ultimately make a decision as to whether or not to approve permits or whatever to allow the pipeline to come into their town. So it's an interesting development from a town who would benefit greatly from this project. The fact that they're saying no. Now, Enbridge has lots of other challenges because they have to go over the Northern Rockies, and that's a lot of First Nations land. And the First Nations people have said no to the pipeline too. So there are a lot of challenges, whether they're trying to go south via TransCanada through this country or west through British Columbia.
You know, so. I'm dating myself terribly, but in the late 70s, when we had kind of our first Arab oil embargo and first energy crisis, I did a lot of zipping around the country, reporting on energy topics, and went to northern Alberta, to the tar sands country, and the scale of development, and this goes back 30 years.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine what it's like today. But I remember 30 years ago going to the tar sand area of northern Alberta and just being blown away. It's all kind of a tamarack pine forest.
Okay.
And they strip away all the trees. And then they pull off the overburden just like a coal strip mine.
Right.
And not very far below the surface is just all this goo. And it's tar sand. It's oily, thick, oily sand.
Right.
And it's kind of you'd get your hands awfully messy, but you could almost grab this and make it into a snowball.
Really?
It sticks together and... It's just kind of nasty stuff.
Right.
And I think that's the big concern, isn't it, is that this is not like pumping liquid oil out of the ground. This creates you have to wash it to get the sand and the oil separated. And that leaves you with this pretty horrific wastewater stream.
Yes.
And the land disturbance and the pipelines and all that goes with pipelines. So,
right.
So this is it's an interesting deposit that's there, and it's not inexhaustible, but there is an awful lot of it covering northern Canada in the western part of the country.
And like you said, this was 30 years ago that this activity was going.
And I was you know, having been many times to the Kennecott Pit and being impressed with the size of those trucks, I mean, the drag lines that were in use 30 years ago up there to pull this out of the ground were massive beyond the Kennecott scale here.
Yes.
And I can't imagine what 30 more years of development has created up there.
Oh, well, and like you say, this is probably oil's equivalent of mountaintop removal. You know, and the companies like to say that they can restore the land once that tar sands has been removed, because they will, like you say, they'll remove the overburden, could be as little as 10, 20 feet of overburden to get to the veins of tar. And then that could be excavated. And that's what all it is. It's basically excavated for the most part initially. And that can be 30, 40, 80 feet of excavation. Then you're left with a pit or a depressed area that could go down into the water table. So now you have water table exposed, which is contaminated. And so they like to talk about restoring that by pushing the overburden back, but you can't
do
that.
You've taken 40-foot layer out of it.
And
so,
now you push the overburden, and so now you have a depressed area which looks nothing like, you know, its original ecosystem or habitat. So it is a permanent – in that sense, it is a permanent scarring of that region. But,
you know, and go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, like you said, there is thousands and thousands of square miles.
And I don't know the extent. It's certainly nowhere near on that scale, but we have tar sands in Utah.
Yeah.
Outside of Vernal, also in the Uinta Basin, where a lot of oil and natural gas extraction is taking place. Now, just look at Highway 40 or Highway 80 and the number of double oil tankers that are heading down the road, and you know that that's all coming out of Uinta Basin area. But one untapped resource there is tar sands, and they exist in Utah along with oil shale. And these are just more types of energy that are in more difficult formations that in Utah we probably won't be dealing with them for some time as long as there's the other oil around, although there are some test projects that are always going. There's a place outside of Vernal called Asphalt Ridge, and it got its name because the oil, the tar, literally on a hot day, and I was there on a hot day filming this, the oil flows out of the rock into little rivulets of oil. Now you have to watch where you step when you're on Asphalt Ridge.
Really?
Because oil is just rolling out of the rocks. And, in fact, the Uinta County Road Department goes up there and quarries it, and they don't have to make tar out of sand and oil. It's already pre-mixed. They just drive up with a bulldozer loaded in a truck and drive it out to a road and patch it.
What? Really?
Yeah, just from the natural deposits. So there, tar sands are maybe a future energy source and a future environmental issue in Utah.
It's something definitely. I mean, tar sands and oil shale oil, however you want to describe it, kerogen type of rock. It's all out there in eastern Utah, and it's all in play. So we have to keep our eye on it.
There's kind of where the three states come together, Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah is kind of the epicenter for those hard-to-get oils.
Yeah.
Locked in rock, locked in tar sand, locked in formations that are hard to get at.
I tell you what, let's take a quick break for an underwriter or two. When we come back, we'll talk a little more about the next topics, a little bit about GMOs, the film I saw, and March being the fourth warmest March on record globally It's This Green Earth. We'll be back right after this.
Spring cleaning, moving, remodeling, donate your gently used construction materials and household items to the ReStore, your local home improvement reuse store today. Visit habitat-utah.org to see our list of accepted items or call 435-487-9015 to learn how to donate to the ReStore. Your donation helps keep thousands of tons of materials out of the waste stream and generates revenues for Habitat's affordable housing programs. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a local nonprofit organization.
La Clínica de Salud de la Gente, una organización sin fines de lucro, le invita a la comunidad venir a una fiesta para celebrar el Mes Nacional de la Salud de las Minorías. La fiesta es sábado, el 12 de abril, de 11 a 2. Se ofrecerán muestras de recetas mexicanas saludables y también habrá evaluaciones de la salud junto con actividades para niños. Llame a la clínica a 435-333-1850 para más detalles.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak. He's Larry Warren. We got a few more minutes I wanted to talk about. GMOs and global temperatures. Totally unrelated topics. Well, that's we're all over the place on This Green Earth. GMOs, genetically modified organisms. There was a really interesting movie here last week called GMO OMG, which talked about the prevalence of genetically modified organisms and genetically engineered crops that are in our food system. Here in the U.S., almost 85% of our food comes from GMOs. It's corn-based, wheat, rice, even our fabrics, cotton, et cetera. A lot of the food and material that we raise, grow in this country is GMO. And people have concerns that we're genetically shifting and modifying these crops to resist pesticides and herbicides and maybe grow faster or grow under drought conditions. And what are the short and long-term health impacts associated with that?
And it began, I guess, with Mendel and others it's a natural genetic
that's exactly
modification where they were just crossbreeding the bigger stalks of corn with whatever.
But it was corn to corn or wheat to wheat or tomatoes to tomatoes. And now they're looking at splicing one type of vegetable to another type and they're trying to take certain aspects of a bacteria and splicing it into a plant. It's a bacteria that, say, resists herbicides and splicing it into a plant. So that's the genetic type of modification that's going on and has people concerned. So the takeaway here is just this. There's a lot of efforts out to make sure that food products aren't labeled. People want to know if their food has GMOs in them.
Well, and, first, tell me this. What's the downside? What could a GMO...
That's the challenge. There is not a lot of research in that area. Some research that has occurred suggests that there could be some cancer-causing aspects to these GMOs. But the research there, the studies are light right now. And so the precautionary principle comes into play. Until we know more about what the impacts are, health effects are with respect to GMOs, why don't we label our food and let people know that people who are concerned about it, that there's GMOs in this food. And there's lots of pushback from Monsanto and the Grocery Manufacturers Association that pushes back and doesn't want labeling done. And there are states that are trying to set legislation that would require all food to have labeling to let people know if there's GMOs in them. And one of them is Oregon. California tried it. It failed. Oregon is next up. And if Oregon doesn't pass it, You will. Well, you know, I would think that they will pass it.
Portlandia land.
Exactly.
Will certainly pass it.
So that's the deal with GMOs. And you know, if it's good for you, if it's healthy, like a lot of the Monsanto and Grocery Manufacturers Association says it is, well, then let's label it. So, okay.
Fair enough.
Finally, got a minute or so. This from NOAA and NASA. March 2014 was the fourth warmest March on record globally, according to the most recent data from NASA.
Well, it felt that way in Park City, that's for sure. There were some awfully late springish days on the ski slopes.
Okay, so the planet's average temperature in March was 57.9 degrees, which is 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit above the average temperature between 1950 and 1980. Now, well, one of the coolest places on the planet was, of course, the East Coast or the Midwest. And remember that the East Coast of the U.S. makes up less than 1% of the surface of the globe. So what happens back in Washington and New York and Detroit and Chicago doesn't necessarily reflect what's going on with the rest of the planet.
Well, that's what people say is we need a little global warming. It's too cold here, but it's like it's too hot somewhere else.
Yes.
And it doesn't all even out.
And it was very warm in places like Western Alaska, Eastern Siberia, Western Europe had temperatures well above average. And like say, maybe even out here, where our March was a little bit above average. But it was the fourth warmest March on record since records were kept. So that's
when,
it.
When were records first kept?
Late
1800s. Is this like a 100-year slice of time?
100, as far as, you know, accurate thermometer-based records, 1850s and on. So 160 years or so. So that's that, where that records are, how records are formally kept.
Okay.
All right, let's take a break for our underwriters. When we come back, we'll have to wrap up. It's this Earth, this Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up. First, let's thank our guests, Dave Eskelson and Paul Murphy from Rocky Mountain Power, talking about Rocky Mountain Power's recent announcement to build a solar farm down in the southern part of the state. That's always good news.
And the fact that they're done building coal plants.
Yeah. How about that?
Good news.
That's great news, too. And, of course, let's thank our underwriters, for whom this show would not be possible. They include Republic Services, Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Vail Resorts, Rocky Mountain Power, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Utah Real Estate. Of course, you can always like us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth, or email us your thoughts and comments at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.